Cisco. Change the order.
Yes, we didn't think you were going to see you.
Yeah,
we
didn't. I didn't think I was going to see you either.
You only have four now.
We've heard stories.
Well, who's outside?
The president's office. And let's never come back.
I know.
Why is it scary?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you not going to do it again?
I'm not going to commit to that.
It's not our hospital, girl.
Oh, okay.
We have a quorum, huh? Open up the House Committee on Health Care, call to order, and move to the order of business of possible introduction of committee bills. Open a work session. We have a committee bill in front of us that's come to us as sort of at our request from the Oregon Health Licensing Authority to deal with some of the problems around body piercing. So if there's no problem, I'd like a motion on this to introduce it as a committee bill.
Chair Greenlick, I move that LC 3889, dated 3/11/11, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Thompson moves that LC 3889, dated 3/11/11, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Today?
Yeah. The measure is introduced as a committee bill, and I will close the work session and get rid of our administrator.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, you can do it. We got a rookie we're trying out today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Put that there. Let them see them. Let's make sure they see that.
You need to introduce yourself, sir.
Oh,
you introduce yourself, please.
My name is Bailey Gell. I'm a legislative policy intern with Committee Services.
Welcome. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3523. And call the first panel, Representative Hoyle, Dr. Robin Henderson. I have two others. Dr. Mario Marquez, 2-3. Okay, we'll try that first. Can you explain the bill to the committee?
Sure. House Bill 3523 authorizes Oregon Medical Board to issue certificates of prescriptive authority to certain licensed psychologists who meet specified requirements.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle.
Hi. For the record, my name is Val Hoyle. I represent West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador in Lane County, and I would like to thank you very much for being here to listen to my testimony. In 2007, the House passed a bill on parity, saying that we should treat mental health and physical health equally, the same. And that isn't how it's always been. This is a bill that gets us closer to parity because it allows people who are mentally ill to have the same access to treatment that people who are physically ill have. If someone has a physical health problem, they can get medication and treatment with a nurse practitioner, with a physician's assistant, through a number of different ways. And yet if somebody is mentally ill, they can see a prescribing psychiatrist. In Eastern Oregon, someone is in Baker County. Unless they go to the prison, it is 4 hours to the nearest prescribing psychiatrist. That is not parity. I've said it before and I'll say it again. When we force people to access mental health care through our prison system, that is not fair, that is not equal, that is not parity. This bill provides that psychologists, not every psychologist, but psychologists who are interested in pursuing both behavioral health care management and the ability to prescribe, go through a series of trainings so that they can deliver medication alongside of of other behavioral health services. I think that this is an integrated care model. When we talk about having health care providers working to the top of their experience, the top of their licensure, this is one step closer, and I think that this will help us in our effort to provide people the appropriate care in the appropriate place, and I'm hoping that we can support this bill.
Thank you very much.
Any questions, or can I come back up?
Can we stop you from coming back?
Sorry?
Can we stop you from coming back?
No.
We would be delighted to have you join us, but are there any questions? Thank you very much.
I think that's a great
overview.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Before we go any further, I want to point out that this hearing will end at 4 o'clock to move to the second session. We have about 13 or 14 people who want to testify, so I'm going to ask you to try and be somewhat brief, and as opposed to the way I've done it in the past, I'm going to call up a panel. This is about evenly balanced, for and against. I'll call up a panel of people for and a panel of people against and see if I can keep track of it all. Dr. Henderson.
Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Robin Henderson. I am a licensed psychologist here in the state of Oregon, and I represent the Oregon Psychological Association. I am here today to support the introduction of House Bill 3523, which would grant prescriptive authority to appropriately train prescribing psychologists. As you well remember, in 2007, this bill was presented to this very committee, and Representative Kotek, in mid-session, created a work group of psychiatrists and psychologists to try to come to an agreement of what it might look like for psychologists who had additional training to prescribe. That bill did not make it out of Ways and Means that year, so in 2009, we brought the bill back, and it passed out of the House and out of the Senate with a recommendation for a formal interim work group, a scope of practice work group that was convened by Senator Manus Anderson and I believe Representative Kenemer and others, to have psychologists and psychiatrists and a family physician and a psychopharmacologist work together with a mediator, which we did between 2009 and 2010, and we came back with a consensus recommendation for a bill that was presented to you in 2010. That bill was passed by the House, by the Senate, and then vetoed by the governor, and thus we are back with you again today with House Bill 3523. My job is to explain to you the key differences. Yes, sir.
Just correct the record. I was an observer, not a member of that committee.
Thank you very much. It was Representative Kotek.
Thank you.
My brain got fuzzy.
I just wanted to be clear.
They look a lot alike.
Yeah.
I got in on the 1:30 a.m. flight from D.C. I would like to review with you the key differences. Thank you, Representative. My apologies
for
the
oversight. Sorry to interrupt you, but
no worries.
I got to clear it up right away.
It's true. I want to talk to you about the key differences between the bill that came out that was vetoed by the governor and the bill that you have before you today, just very briefly. We removed the recommended work group. Last year's bill did create an additional third work group of psychologists and psychiatrists to look at this for a third time. We removed that workbook and actually actualized the recommendations of the interim work group to really strengthen and spell out the training program, the clinical training program for you. And the clinical training program is spelled out as having 24-month clinical training program experience in conjunction with a longitudinal outpatient experience. Clinical training is based upon competency completed under the contract of residency supervision of at least one psychiatrist and approved by the Committee on Prescribing Psychologists set forth in the 2010 legislation. This includes a year of clinical experience in a general medical center and at least 3 months of clinical experience in specialized settings if the psychologist intends to work with a specialized population, and at least an additional 2 months in a mental health setting in direct collaboration with the psychiatrist. We also set forth a process for conditional prescribing license. So during that 24-month clinical training portion, a psychologist could prescribe with the written, the written right along there on my signature, they're signing together. They could prescribe for that additional first 2 years. So every time the psychologist writes a prescription, the supervising psychiatrist is signing off on that. All the other provisions of the bill still remain. We're required to document collaboration with the primary care provider for the patient prior to writing the first prescription. No other discipline is held to that standard of care and of working together in an integrated setting. We did neglect to put the amendment that was recommended last year that would give the collaborating provider liability, you know, freedom from liability in the event of an adverse outcome. That has been submitted to Legislative Council for review. It is the same caveat that was in the 2010 legislation, and it was an oversight on our part to not put it in 2011. So when you come back for work session, you will have that amendment back in here. The last piece that I want to bring to your attention, and I will answer any questions that you've got, is, you know, a little over 25 years ago, the Oregon legislature was a leader in making nurse practitioners able to prescribe in the state of Oregon. And the physician community rallied and said, people will die if we do this. People will die. 5 years after that time, there were studies conducted looking at the outcomes of nurse practitioners as prescribers, not only in Oregon, but in other states that enacted that legislation. And you know what we found out? The rates were about the same. You know, they really were no discernible difference. But at the end of the day, the patient satisfaction increased for nurse practitioners. And those studies are very important because what we're talking about is providing another alternative. Nobody is mandating that a patient go to a psychologist who's prescribing. It is still somebody's choice at the end of the day who they see. We want to provide an additional alternative, and I'd like to introduce you to my friend, Dr. Mario Marquez, who's going to speak after me to tell you what it's like for him in his state.
Are there questions in that case? I usually wait to the panels, but at least I'm going to ask a question. I don't know if anybody else does. The criticism that I hear the most from people who send me emails, and this doesn't get quite as many emails as my bike proposal, but it's
kind of... Do we need to talk about that?
That's not our committee.
Is the criticism of the training program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get statements like, well, a side B with a few classes on the internet really isn't really qualified to be prescribing drugs. Would you comment on that comment?
I would be happy to. And Representative, I would agree with you. A PsyD with a few classes on the internet wouldn't be qualified. There is a program out there referred to as PPR. I can't remember what PPR stands for, but that program is an internet-based program that has a few weekend CEUs. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a full-on two-year postdoctoral master's degree where you have the type of Moodle-based educational experiences used by OHSU, by UW, and many other institutions for training people in rural areas, where you have the ability to see the PowerPoint on the screen and interact with the professor live. And I actually have some Moodle clips, if the committee would be interested in seeing what lectures look like segments from lectures, because the coolest thing about Moodle that I've learned is that you can go back in afterwards and you can watch the class again. You can see it. They take attendance. There are attendance requirements. And then adding the 24-month clinical training program means we now have to have somebody supervising, watching you put hands on patients. That's what makes the difference for me and makes me feel that my patients would be well served.
Thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead, please.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, I am Mario Marquez, Dr. Mario Marquez. I'm a prescribing psychologist in New Mexico, and it's a real honor to be here with you. Thank you for having me here. I hope I can convince you to support this important piece of legislation here in Oregon. I work with children and adolescents, and I've been working with kids for about 25 years, the last 5 years as a prescriber. And I'm here to tell you today that, contrary to what others may say, our safety record is amazing. For over 15 years, psychologists have been prescribing either in the military, in New Mexico, and Louisiana. And during those 15 years, hundreds of thousands of prescriptions have been written, and not a single negative complaint has been registered against any of the psychologists writing prescriptions across the country. We have prescribing psychologists in the U.S. Navy, we have prescribing psychologists in the U.S. Army and in the Air Force, in the U.S. Public Health Services Corps, and in Indian Health Services. Our safety record is impeccable. It's something that we strive for. It's something that we're very proud of. And we hope to continue in this pattern. So anyone that tells you that we're a public health hazard doesn't have their facts straight. There is no evidence to support that opposition, and yet we do have evidence. In fact, I have a handout here that I'd like to leave with you when I'm done, and I have a letter from the chair of the New Mexico Board of Psychological Examiners saying there have been no complaints against any of the psychologists in New Mexico. And the same thing holds true for the state of Louisiana. We haven't had any negative complaints. Very important information for you to have. But, you know, that doesn't begin to speak of all the other benefits having prescribing psychologists around the country and in the state of Oregon. It doesn't begin to speak of all the people that we've taken off unnecessary overprescribed drugs. I'm very happy to tell you here that in my work with children, I have actually taken kids off more drugs than I actually prescribe. The over-medicating of our children and the elderly is just immoral, almost, in my opinion. So our safety record is without question. You know, the authority to prescribe is also the authority not to prescribe. And as psychologists, our philosophy is we use the behavioral psychotherapeutic approaches, the social approaches, as a first-line treatment, especially with children and adolescents. Medication is a last resort and used only as an adjunct. And we're very, very staunch on that point in terms of our psychological training. We're psychologists first, and we're prescribers second. And this is the way we practice. And I practice this way in New Mexico, and I'm sure the psychologists in Oregon will do the same. Not only is having prescriptive authority the ability not to prescribe, but in addition to that, it's the power, the authority to unprescribe. And this is where psychologists can really play a role in our mental health system in this country. There is just too many psychotropic medications out there. Billions of dollars are being made by the pharmaceutical companies, and the idea of this polypharmacy has gotten out of control. And we're here to try to help kids take them off those medications. Research has shown that it's a combination of psychotherapy and medications work best, not one or the other. Well, as prescribing psychologists, we have that opportunity to utilize both techniques. And like I say, we tend to be very conservative, very cautious, very systematic in our prescribing. In terms of education, I have here 4 licenses. There's a safety net involved in psychologist prescribing. I have a license from the New Mexico Board of Psychologist Examiners to practice as a psychologist. I have a license from the Psychology Board, Medical Board, to practice as a prescribing psychologist. I have a license from the New Mexico Board of Pharmacy, registering me as a prescriber. And I have a license from the Department of the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency. There is a safety net. Any Oregonian psychologist that obtains prescriptive authority will have to go through all these licenses to be able to prescribe. Most psychologists are senior psychologists. These aren't for early career psychologists. Most of us have a bachelor's in psychology, a master's in psychology, and a doctorate in psychology, and then an additional master's in psychopharmacology. No other behavioral health care professional has the type of training that we have. It's worked well in New Mexico. I know it'll work well here in Oregon. It's worked well in Louisiana. And if the military, our U.S. forces, can have a program where psychologists prescribe, I think the rest of the country can go forward. Another point to make is that our philosophy includes treating the patients, the children, their families. We don't adhere to the 5-10 minute med check. We're interested in doing the hard labor, behavioral interventions, social interventions, psychotherapy that really creates the change. To us, medication is temporary. It may treat some of the symptoms, but if you want to get long-lasting benefit, you have to go in there and do the hard behavioral interventions. And that's our first order of business. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And thank you very much for hearing me out.
One of my issues is rural mental health care. Do you have any empirical data that this has increased delivery of mental health care in rural areas of New Mexico?
Yes, sir. I actually have a chart of where the prescribing psychologists are located. We have about 30 psychologists that are prescribing in New Mexico at different levels, either conditionally or as an independently. And most of our psychologists, not all of them, but most of them are practicing in rural areas. I personally practice in a rural area, and I mainly treat Medicaid kids and their families. 90% of my caseload is with Medicaid children and adolescents and their families. And like I say, most of my work is taking kids off of medications. I get patients coming in that are released from hospitals, residential treatment centers, treatment foster care, on 6, 7, 5, 8 different kinds of medications. And our law, as does the Oregon law, requires us to collaborate with the primary care practitioners. And I call some of these primary care practitioners, and they're just appalled at the amount of drugs that some of these children are on. And I work with the primary care practitioner to get those kids off of the drugs, to get them to exercise, to get them to eat right, to sleep right. We work with the parents to discipline them, to give them the proper nurturance and structure their time and take them away from all these antipsychotics and these mood stabilizers that are just driving our kids nuts. It's got to stop somewhere. This is why I went into it originally. I went in this not to be able to prescribe medications, but to be able to take kids off of the drugs, because I was seeing what these drugs were doing to these kids. Now, are drugs bad? No. It used properly, they're very helpful, and they can save lives, and they can be a benefit. But we've gotten to a point in our society where it's out of control. So, yes, we do. I don't know if I answered your question.
You answered it.
I mean, yeah. But the point is that it's helped in New Mexico. We have 30
and I'll get to the
prescribing psychologists. We're almost to match the number of psychiatrists in our state. There's not many more psychiatrists than that, and we're ready to match them. In another 5 years, we'll have more prescribing psychologists. We'll have more kids and the elderly. We haven't talked about the elderly. Taking them off of medications. So it's worked in our state. I'd be happy to put you in touch with our sponsor over there and some of the other senators, representatives. They've talked to other senators and representatives from around the country, and be happy to put you in touch with them. But we do have information that has helped our state, and especially with the poor, the underserved, those that need the treatment the most and are least likely to get it.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Another question?
No.
Comment?
No, I'm...
Representative Cannon?
I'm satisfied for a change.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Well, I think it's really quite interesting for us to talk to somebody who's actually doing this in another state. I don't think we've had that opportunity any of our other hearings. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate your point about appropriately using medication, but I'm having trouble understanding the notion that a prescribing psychologist... can unprescribe, or help me with that connection, because really it's a patient who chooses to see a psychologist who then chooses not to prescribe, but that presumably can and should be happening today. Patients who may be getting prescriptions from a GP or psychiatrist, pediatrician, whomever, might also be getting or might choose at some point to see a psychologist who says, look, I think there's some other ways to handle this. Can that not happen today?
Yes, it can happen today. And this is done in collaboration with the primary care practitioner. In our law and in this law, collaboration is mandatory. So any prescription that's written or any prescription that is being discontinued has to be collaborated or approved by the primary care practitioner.
Representative Cannon, I think you're asking a different question. You're asking of me I'm a generally licensed psychologist. Can I look at a patient and say, you know what, I really think you need to get off that medication? I would get spanked by my licensing board right now under the current law. I can't make recommendations about medications to a to a physician or to a patient. I can talk about them from a base of knowledge, but if I start making recommendations for how they're taking their medication, that's not within my current scope of practice. Within the scope of practice that we're proposing, that they have in New Mexico and that they have in Oregon, if we have this additional scope, then yes, indeed, I could have that conversation if I had the appropriate training. But right now, under current Oregon law, I would be in a little bit of dodge.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
I'd like to ask you, could you describe what your master's training was like?
Yes, it's similar. It's similar to the proposed statute or bill.
Did you go through that same program?
It's basically a master's degree in psychopharmacology, and it is the American Psychological Association has studied this training curriculum over a period of about 10 years now, and it started off with the Department of Defense demonstration project, and since that training program, it's been tweaked, I guess you can say, to where now the training meets the standards of the American Psychological Association.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I may.
Whoever.
I can be quiet too if you want me to, Chair.
I don't ever want you to be quiet.
That's why I get along with you so well. I kind of want to dig a little deeper because we've heard a lot of stories and we've had a lot of people come into our offices to discuss this. And one of the issues that I've seen is lack of communication between the medical industry and psychologist. Right now, if I understand this right, the way we said, an MD, general practitioner, can issue psychotropic drugs to a patient
mm-hmm.
without ever seeing you.
Yes.
If they come to you and you know they need to be on a psychotropic drug, do you communicate with a physician or recommend that they go see a physician? How do you handle it in that situation?
Right now, currently, and I'll speak to what happens in Central Oregon, is happening in my own clinic. We have a very large population of Oregon Health Plan patients. And so our standard protocol, when we see a patient who we know needs to be on medication, therapist calls the primary care practitioner and says, hey, you know, Mary Jo is depressed. Think you might want to take a look at some type of an intervention for her. We're going to talk about this in therapy, but there you go. Now the first question is, if I can get to the primary care practitioner, yay for me, because a lot of times what I get to is the nurse in the clinic, and I'll share that information. And then it's incumbent upon the patient then to make an appointment and follow up. And mind you, I'm talking primarily an Oregon Health Plan population. So they're going to have to get an appointment with their FQHC and get in there and see their practitioner and hopefully get arranged on some type of medication. If that doesn't work and they want to get in with a psychiatrist who has additional training, the current wait list in Central Oregon to get an appointment with a psychiatrist is somewhere between 3 and 5 months. And that's if you have commercial insurance. If you have Oregon Health Plan, it actually is a little bit longer than that. And if you're a child with the Oregon Health Plan right now, it is very, very close to significantly impossible. So for us, we're in a fairly what I would tend to call urban-rural mix area, and we're struggling mightily with access to prescribers. But
all the answers.
Theoretically, yes.
Thank you. Follow up?
We have lots of other people that can deal with this, too.
Representative Parrish and then Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. So kind of a little bit of a two-part thing. One is, you mentioned working with a lot of government plans and the military, and which certainly is a different payment model than private insurance. So one piece of the question is in the states where you're doing this, any concerns with private insurance going, yeah, we're not going to reimburse you for that service because we don't want to take the risk, the potential risk. The other question I have is, you know, a lot of the examples that you did give were adults, and you spoke to children a little bit. I'm a mom with three kids. I have one child on meds, and we resisted for a very long time to even get that far. And the sheer amount of effort that my pediatrician put in terms of monitoring and blood pressure and come back in and do all that, do you have that kind of training to be able to look at the physical aspect of what some of those drugs do to children? Or, I mean, adults certainly can kind of speak for themselves. Sometimes kids, it's hard to monitor that. My kids don't always communicate those things well to me. So having the doctor and the nurse be involved, and my doctor's, my pediatrician's nurse calling me once a week to follow up, do you have the capability to do those things in your field? Do you have a nurse practitioner or somebody who's doing that work for you in your office?
The answer is yes. Part of the training is coursework in pathophysiology and physical assessment. And we also rely, for example, with some of the children that I treat in the schools, the school nurse is available, the primary care physician, the primary care practitioner actually likes, with most of my patients, they actually like to care of that, to take care of that part of the work. So they go in for regular checkups. Before we even put a child on a medication, I ask the primary care physician to do a complete physical exam, and we get baseline blood work and maybe an EKG, depending on the situation. And so they are monitored very closely, and I do the monitoring, and I am able to take blood pressures. Usually, though, the primary care health practitioners would rather do it themselves. So I yield to the PCPs in those instances where they would rather do that, but I'm capable of doing it, and I have done it with some of my patients.
Thank you.
Now, as far as the first question goes, this is a step-by-step process. We're still in our infancy. There's only two states and in the military, but we have worked with the insurance companies, and the insurance companies are coming around. They are slowly but surely starting to reimburse us for that work. And as time goes on, more insurance companies are reimbursing us appropriately.
Representative Kenema? Dr. Kenema?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Greenlick. Dr. Marquez, I want to particularly address one issue. You are a child psychologist rather than simply a psychologist, so you're a specialist, if I understood correctly. And I guess part of my response is, as we've all been receiving lots of comments and concerns, one of the major ones has been that one of the things that psychologists would be least fit to treat would be children, and that is a very special case and very special needs, and would need considerable training and experience beyond what this bill requires. And I wondered if you would address that issue and the patient safety.
Yes, of course. Thank you for the question. Well, I'm living, walking proof that psychologists can treat children and adolescents safely and effectively, both psychologically and through medications. Most of the psychologists that are going to be applying for the prescriptive authority, like I mentioned earlier, are senior psychologists. For example, I myself have been working with kids for about over 25 years, the last five as a prescriber. So those Oregon psychologists who will be receiving their prescriptive authority will not be practicing out of their scope of expertise, out of their area of expertise. So if you're a child psychologist in Oregon and you apply for the prescriptive authority, you'll continue to work with children. Someone who gets prescriptive authority won't start working with geriatrics, for example. So, yes, it does take a special individual, special person to work with children. And the training, I understand, in the bill, mm-hmm. Requires specialty with pediatrics. If you're going to work with children. So in answer to your question, it can be done safely, it can be done effectively. Like I mentioned earlier, there have been no negative complaints, and there's various child psychologists that are prescribing in New Mexico and in Louisiana, and so far things have worked out well. We tend to be very, like I said, systematic, objective, cautious. There's evidence that we prescribe less and that we use our behavioral approaches more. And so I think we'll continue to be safe and effective with children.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me call the next panel. Tanya Tompkins, Shelley Joyce, and Dr. Jet Malani.
you so much for your time. I apologize that I sound like this, but I'm fighting a cold. My name is Tanya.
You need a psychologist to treat. Maybe you need a psychologist to treat.
Yeah, or maybe an MD. I don't know. I need something more than my cough drop. It's not helping. I'm a professor of psychology at Winfield College. I hold a PhD in clinical psychology with a minor in measurement and psychometrics from UCLA. I'm here today to testify in strong opposition to this bill, which will allow psychologists with significantly less preparatory training and background than any other non-physician prescribers to prescribe medication. I have a wide range of basic concerns that I've shared with many of you individually, and I actually did all...
Your name and your introduction?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And I did actually pass that out as well. It's a 2-page opposition sheet. I'm not going to go through all those concerns out of interest of time. But what I want to focus on are sort of two basic issues, and would argue that this legislation has failed not only here but in 24 states over 100 times, in part because this expansion of scope of practice is not a data-driven solution to a clearly identified problem, but instead is a top-down, power-driven attempt to identify a shortcut path to gaining prescription privileges. Despite significant disagreement among psychologists nationally and here in Oregon, this type of legislation has been pushed strongly by the American Psychological Association, which I'll refer to as APA from here on out. It's often mischaracterized as a turf battle, as my presence suggests, as well as the POPP petition that I'm sending around to you right now. It's a controversial debate within the field. And to kind of highlight that contentiousness, psychologists are deeply divided over this issue, and the APA is attempting to change us from being a biopsychosocial profession to being a medical one by seeking prescription privileges. And in fact, the APA suspended its parliamentary rules back in 95 to adopt this position because there was opposition within, and yet they wanted to move forward. The Society for a Science of Clinical Psychology, SSCP, is a division of APA. And it's an active and influential member of scientist practitioners that focus on evidence-based practice. And in 2001, so 10 years ago, they wrote a position paper in opposition to expanding prescription privileges to psychologists. They said, we need an open vetting of this issue within the profession. We need a moratorium on spending and advocacy on this issue until we meet these resolutions. One of the resolutions was a survey of all psychologists that are members of APA. And to publish those results in an APA journal.
Can I point out that we don't have APA testimony in favor of this? This is not an APA bill. This is a bill.
OPA and APA is a part of that.
This is a bill introduced by the committee. And it might be useful if you limit your testimony to the substance of the bill and not about politics and in your professional association.
Out of all due respect, I think this is a political issue, and that is the point that I'm trying to make.
Out of all due respect, it's a political issue for the state of Oregon, not around your political association. I mean, not around your professional association. It would help your process if you talk about why you think it's a bad idea.
Okay. But again, I would argue that if this moratorium on spending would have happened, we wouldn't be sitting here debating this issue for 8 years, but we're still here.
Are you following your testimony, or are you interested in testifying on the issue?
I'd like to get to Oregon psychologists now, if I may. If that would be okay.
All right.
So following last year's veto in 2010, I was interested in trying to understand what Oregon psychologists think and know about this issue. And I'm in the midst of data collection now, so I have preliminary data from 83 Oregon psychologists. And the data paint a very clear picture, I would argue, that rather than consensus of all psychologists supporting this, instead there's division, with very few seeking to pursue prescription privileges. For example, just under 44% were in favor, just under 21% were undecided, and 36% were in opposition. And only 7% of folks indicated that they'd be interested in pursuing this pathway. So if we think about it from an access issue and improving care for mental health, we're not talking about large numbers of folks who could do this. Of those that expressed interest in training, the majority of them did have PsyDs and no science background. in terms of hard sciences and biological sciences. My second concern involves safety concerns. There's a clear risk to consumers because of inadequate medical training. I know they suggested that there have been hundreds of thousands of prescriptions written, which I have a hard time reconciling in terms of the ability to unprescribe why so many were written. But safety should be first and foremost on everyone's mind, particularly when we're talking about a vulnerable group of folks, as the mentally ill are. And proponents have also made reference to the DOD, Defense Psychopharmacology Demonstration Project. The three things that you should know about this project. One, the military discontinued it because it was not cost-effective. Two, the training requirements outlined in this bill bear little resemblance to that program in terms of the requirements for medical training, didactic training, and background of the individuals who pursue this. And three, all 10 graduates considered these shortcut programs, which this is, such as those in this bill right now, are, quote, ill-advised. All 10 of them said we should be doing 3 years of training, not, 2 years of training. And as you know, the MS in clinical psychopharm is sort of the didactic training piece of this bill. It's purportedly based on APA training model, but several do offer less than Evans recommended there, and the APA model itself is less training than the DOD model. Most of these MS programs, as he's talked about some of the coursework that he did, we're talking about the equivalent of 7 to 10 undergraduate, similar to undergraduate courses that you might have taken in college. These are through distance ed, offered mostly out of state, mostly for-profit institutions, don't require any sort of prerequisites in terms of science background, no examinations to get in, and they're graded on a pass, no pass basis. And I would argue that it shouldn't be lost on anyone on this committee that also we don't have folks from colleges and universities in Oregon who are supporting this bill or who are equipped to provide an MS in clinical psychopharm. So we're talking about people who would be pursuing this training doing so out of state. Ronald Fox, who is a past president of the APA, acknowledges that the RXP training has, quote, the least overlap with traditional medical curricula, and that implementing this training relies upon, quote, the public sector as an experimental laboratory for society. And I would argue that we simply shouldn't allow Oregon to experiment with how little training we can get to, have this race to the bottom approach, see the minimal amount of training we can have in order to prescribe medications to some of our most vulnerable citizens. It's simply not fair. It stigmatizes the mentally ill and something that we should not do. So I urge you to vote no on this bill and future bills until this profession can demonstrate consensus and provide clear data, empirical data, not just anecdotal data, that suggests that this is safe and effective and cost-effective to a clearly defined problem. I think we have a mental health care shortage, but not necessarily a shortage in terms of prescribers. And I thank you for your time, and I hope I got back on track.
Thank you. You did.
Yeah.
Very helpful.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Shelley Joyce. I'm a policy advisor for Oregon Family Support Network. And for those of you who are not familiar with us, we are a statewide, nonprofit, family-run organization that works with families who have children with mental, emotional, behavioral, and sometimes developmental disabilities. OFSN is in opposition to House Bill 3523. There are several red flags in this bill that cause us concern, starting with the Committee on Prescribing Psychologists. This committee will be recommending clinical training programs and setting the standards for those clinical training programs. The membership on the committee consists of 4 psychologists, one of whom is the chair, and 3 licensed physicians, only one who has to be a psychiatrist. A majority vote is all that's needed to pass on recommendations. This is like asking the fox to guard the hen house. With psychologists always in the majority, there's the chance that the ideas or objections by the 3 licensed physicians can be voted down by the majority. Furthermore, the bill aims at serving all populations, yet there are no child psychiatrists or gerontologists on this committee. OFSN believes that this committee needs to have equal representation between psychologists, psychiatrists, primary care practitioners, and it should also include people who are actively involved in developing training programs. The committee will make recommendations around clinical training programs, and OFSN strongly feels that there is not enough broad representation on this committee to recommend clinical training programs that will have high standards that address all populations. The bill is vague in the training standards that must be included as a minimum. With the lack of broad representation of healthcare professionals, we fear that the training standards will not be rigorous enough. Moving away from the committee and onto another concern, the bill says that there will be 3 months of clinical experience in working with vulnerable populations. 3 months is not enough time to gain expertise on these special populations, especially children. Finally, families assume that anyone with the title of doctor has medical training and experience. The prescribing psychologist will have this title, but not necessarily the rigorous medical training that physicians go through. We strongly feel that families need to be aware of this so that they can make informed decisions. For all these reasons, OFSN believes that this bill in this form is not beneficial to children and could actually cause harm. We have psychiatrists for a reason. They have medical education and experience that psychologists lack. The stacked deck on the committee for prescribing psychologists has the power to railroad through training standards over the objections of the other three doctors. The possibility of abuse by the majority leads us to believe that this bill will not have the teeth to develop training standards that are rigorous, meaningful, and comprehensive for all populations. An OFSN requests that you do not pass House Bill 3523. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to apologize to Ms. Tompkins. It turns out when I'm looking at the written testimony we do have written testimony in support of the bill from the American Psychological Association and from its ex-president, so you were talking about relevant issues. We also have a letter in support of the bill from Dr. Jay Carter and a letter opposed to the bill from Don Moore. So we'll put those into the record. Thank you. Yes.
Representative Co-Chair Greenlick and Representative Co-Chair Thompson and other members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this bill. Representative Greenlick, can you clarify the time that's left?
If you take about 3 or 4 minutes, it would be fine.
3 or 4 minutes, okay.
I'm going to extend this till 15 after. If the next group is here, Bruce and Mike here. Oh, there you are. 15. Yeah, that should, 45 minutes should be enough, right?
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
And we have five more witnesses after you. So
okay, thanks very much.
3 or 4 minutes should be.
I am Ajit Jemalani. I'm a board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist and director of OHSU Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and the director of fellowship education at OHSU. I'm also immediate past president of Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I grew up here in Oregon. I practiced medicine for the last 22 years in our state, and I worked at every level of children's mental health, including hospitals, residential, group homes for developmentally disabled, outpatient services, and in the public and private sector. I've also volunteered many hundreds of hours for MH and CAF, including membership on the Children's System Advisory Committee and on committees related to implementing last year's legislation on the psychotropic prescribing to children in foster care bill. I feel I have an extensive background in what's happening in our state and the needs of our children and families. To me, there's no greater challenge and importance than fully understanding the complexity and the nuance of brain, mind, and body interaction. The ranging outcomes of human development at these levels impact society and culture on who we become and profoundly affect the person, family, and community as a whole. Medical training, many people describe medical training as taking a sip out of a fire hydrant. The material is coming so fast and furious that you really need repetition to absorb that material. I'm sure that's true in psychology training as well. And by the way, it's uncomfortable for me to be here because I have friends who are psychologists, many colleagues who are psychologists, and I greatly admire and respect psychology training. And I think collaboration between the two fields is critical to what's best for our kids and families. in order to understand rapidly expanding and complex scientific developments, there's necessary basic elements to medical training. The drugs that we have today are not the medicines that we may have in 5, 10, or 20 years. To be able to move along with those changes and what we have for our children and families, there needs to be a foundation in basic sciences in college and thousands of hours of repetition and patient care-based learning that occur in the 9 years of medical education and training that follow. And it doesn't have to be 9 years for this purpose. However, that is what child psychiatrists have. We, with all due respect to the gentleman from New Mexico, who sounds like would be a great colleague, I'd enjoy working with him, we do think of children in a biopsychosocial way and attempt to use non-medical approaches first wherever possible. And the reason why we use excessive psychotropics, I believe, in many children, as is particularly true in foster kids, is that we have inadequate psychosocial therapies available to them, and poverty and violence in our society and trauma are rampant. We have to safely and effectively treat children with disruptions in normal development. It is a special responsibility, and this has been something that's been highlighted to all of you, I think, in many testimonies. The properly trained medical provider writes prescriptions with a background of integrated knowledge, including visceral memory of a very ill and dying, to activate care and caution, all we recommend. I would suggest to you that we're not talking about the training that a provider gets after they've completed psychology training. We're talking about the trajectory of training you need to become a medical provider. This is about medical care. This is not about simply prescribing pills. And you are, I think this bill focuses on the presumption, a number of presumptions that I'd like to speak to. One presumption is that the people who take this training are the cream of the crop. Actually, training really should be focused on the mediocre candidate to assure that the mediocre person, in fact, graduates as a safe provider of care. I also do not believe that we need more access to psychotropic prescribing in our state. We actually need better psychosocial therapies available, particularly in a co-located setting in the medical home environment, which is, I think, the future of our medical system. This is not helping psychologists practice at the top of their license. This is a separate, again, a separate pathway to medical training. This is not increasing the at the top of the license. This is another whole process of understanding how to prescribe. I'll just finish by saying that I do not believe that the one example of training is the Alliant program, which has 12 hours of didactic training in children. And that is the special population training in the Alliant brochure. 3 months of clinical experience is not enough clinical experience for a person to prescribe to children. If they don't have 25 years of experience working with children, as the gentleman from New Mexico had, let's say they're fresh out of practice, is 3 months enough exposure? And how will you determine whether that's an adequate background to partake in this training? Some of the medicines that we have are the most complex and dangerous. Wrap things up. Okay. I would also comment, finally, that you cannot get a training program for free. I have to manage the budget of my training program. It costs about $100,000 to train a child psychiatrist annually. There is a cost to implementing a program like this, and that has to be based in reality. I don't believe that we can create a training program for free. I think you'll get the value of investment, as was true last year in the process that we had. I respectfully urge members of the committee to vote no on this legislation. It's not the right solution to Oregon's access struggles, and it's a dangerous departure from every other category of medical training in our state. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much.
Just a quick question. You indicated a number of presumptions. I got cream of the crop. Number two is more access to medical experts. And your other points were?
Well, I chopped some of them out.
I was listening.
Could you send us some more written material?
Yes,
that'd be great. I'd love to have
material that I've submitted. Thank you, sir.
That'd be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Real quick. Yes, sir. Have you been through the bill? Because you're talking about collaboration and stuff, and that's what this bill takes into consideration, too, when I'm sitting here going through it.
and it's trying to get the medical community and the psychology working together, which to me, that would be the ideal solution.
Yes, I think the collaboration is critical. Multi-specialty collaboration is a critical way to provide good outcomes to kids. But when you're sitting in your office, if psychologists would like to have an independent practice of medicine, then really they need to be capable of sitting in their office and recognizing if a child has early signs of diabetes, if they have early signs of bone marrow suppression, and be able to identify medical problems that are masquerading as mental health issues. The collaboration is important, but it leaves room for great error if the person who's prescribing doesn't have those skills themselves. And the collaborator, let's say a primary care gets a call from a psychologist who has this ability, they are relying on the psychologist's eyes to deliver the data for them to make an interpretation on what to do next. When I collaborate with a primary care doctor, I know that they can see medical signs and symptoms. I don't believe that didactic training is adequate to prepare somebody to do that.
I may follow up. Because with this, I mean, it looks like it's bringing collaboration together and everything, but I know if I was a medical doctor and a psychologist sent somebody to me, because I kind of do this with machinery, I'll listen to the people and what they're saying. This is what the symptom is. It's vibrating or this is going on. And then I think, okay, what could trigger those problems for this condition?
Mm-hmm.
And now I analyze, okay, is it this? No. Is it this? No. Oh, it's got these two here, so it's this one. And I would think a medical doctor would do the same thing if a psychologist was collaborating with them or vice versa. There'd be communication between the two.
Yeah, there would be communication between the two, but it's the question is, can the psychologist pick up the subtle symptoms and the complex issues involved?
Okay. Excuse this panel.
Thank you.
I have one question. I'm sorry for them.
Okay. Very briefly.
I'm just very curious. I've always kind of encouraged people in my own profession to get more training, to be able to do more. And I'm kind of curious as to why you're discouraging your own professionals from going through and being able to expand their practice, expand their education, expand things to help people. It's very curious. I'm just
well, we actually offered...
Quick answer, please.
Yes, we offered a physician assistant program training for a psychologist to actually get adequate medical training to be able to prescribe a number of years ago, and that was rejected.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that why are now? I mean, there are people that want to go through and do this. So why would you discourage your own profession?
I would not discourage them from getting adequate training to prescribe medications. Okay. I'm concerned about the training itself.
And I would just add that there are two different levels of training as well, level one and level two, that would provide the ability to collaborate but not prescribe. So they were talking about the ability to unprescribe. If you have sort of a level two license, you'd be able to have enough background to talk in an intelligent way.
But you're still discouraging your people from getting more.
But you would, I mean, you'd have a collaborative relationship
really
and be able to
on.
Talk. Okay, I can give you more information if you'd like.
We have about 11 more minutes. We have five more people. So I'd like Dr. Julian and Dr. Peterson next, please. Please hold it about 2 minutes, if you could.
I'll try and do it in 1 minute.
All right.
Robert Julian, I'm a licensed physician in the state of Oregon. I also have my PhD in psychopharmacology. I have authored a textbook on psychopharmacology now for 36 years. This is the 12th edition. I educate psychologists all over the United States. The group here that is applying for prescription privileges is the cream of the crop. All will not want it. They don't want to work that hard. They don't want to go through this. As New York Times pointed out a couple weeks ago, our psychiatrists have become med managers not doing this work. I've been working very closely with the Louisiana practitioners, and they have not become this model. They still do their 50-minute session and can modify prescriptions as necessary. Incredibly responsible model. As far as training, they talk about child psychiatry. The family practitioner who writes most of these prescriptions has minimal training in child psychiatry. Much more here, and I think they can actually do as good a job, an even better job, working in collaboration with the primary care physicians and take some of this load off of them, because frankly, it's a real millstone around their neck, and this will be a collaborator that can really help. So I support them. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. My name is Mary Peterson, and I'm the Director of Clinical Training at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon. And George Fox is one of the three universities in Oregon that trains doctoral-level psychologists. And I think it's nice that in our field of psychology, we can hold different opinions. So my goal in coming up here is just to provide some background about what a typical doctoral training program provides. It is a five-year program, and it includes 4 years of academic work on campus, and then a fifth year of an internship off campus. And then, in order to be practice ready, most states require a postdoctoral year. So it takes us 6 years to be practice ready. You know, my sister and I started graduate school at the same time. She went to medical school, and I went to psych school. And it didn't seem fair that she was practice ready after 5 years, and I had to wait till six. And I think it begs the question, why does it take so long to do the training? And there are two issues. One is the science and research that is involved. I brought some of the APA guidelines. The expectation is that there's science and research throughout our program. Original dissertation work, as well as knowing evidence-based practices, and science courses including physiological psychology, biological basis of behavior, neuropsychology. It's an important part of how we know what we know. The second reason I think it takes so long is clinical training. The 4 years that they're at Fox, they're in practicum training. Then they do that other full year of internship, and then another year, full year of postdoc work. So by the time a psychologist gets to licensure, they've already had 4,000 hours of clinical training. So I think that those two things, the science and research, as well as the clinical training, really contribute and define the rigor of our program. And given that I'm clinical training, of course, you might say, well, where are they doing clinical training? And right now, 40% of our practicum students are doing clinical training in medical and health environments. You know, I think more and more medical, psychology, social workers, anyone is seeing the benefit of holistic care. And so when our students go in and work in a primary care clinic, they can work side by side and they can address treatment from a multidisciplinary standpoint. And, you know, I think that that science and research foundation makes us uniquely suited to work in healthcare environments. I also think the 6 years of training...
Sorry to do this to you, but you wrap it up.
All right, I'm on my last sentence. So the 6 years provide a nice foundation, I think, then for psychologists to think about and consider psychopharmacology training.
Thank you very much. Can I? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out, and that's the basis, and then after that, you still have to apply the standards here.
Right, right.
And a lot of psychologists, frankly, are not going to do that for
yes.
any number of legitimate reasons, just like nurse practitioners, a good majority of nurses never become a nurse practitioner.
And that would be true for me.
Yep, thank you. Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up three people, and you can divide up 5 minutes any way you want. It's John Munch, Dr. Jim Lace, and Dr. Chandra. I think I might even got that name right. Lace was the hard one. We are going to gavel out at 15 after.
2 minutes, it's not much. I'm John Munch. I'm the Director of Behavioral Medicine for the Department of Family Medicine at OHSU, so I teach a lot of the curriculum to primary care doctors about mental health issues. I'm the principal investigator of the ESPERT Oregon Primary Care Initiative, in which we're trying to integrate addictions, screening, and brief intervention in primary care clinics. And I'm a practicing physician in a community health center where we have integrated psychologists, social workers, along with primary care docs in a model that seems to be very functional. I'm a little confused about part of the argument for prescribing seems to be, A, that there's not enough prescribers in places in Oregon, and yet our population is overwhelmed with prescribers and too much psychotropic medication. So it's hard to make sense of the discrepancy between that. Dr. Marquez also has argued that he's in New Mexico, in a place where the primary care docs and the psychologists very much collaborate on the mental health and physical issues at the same time. Yet the primary care physical health docs also have prescribing privileges in the same places, so it's a little bit hard to understand why we would need more prescribers in a collaborative effort like that. I've passed around the curriculum guidelines for family practice doctors, which are extensive in mental health and behavioral health care, and I'm pretty confident that our residents go out into rural Oregon well prepared to do a good job prescribing psychotropic medications and to do a good job not prescribing psychotropic medications when necessary. They also do a very good job recognizing when there are physical sequelae of the medications that they've prescribed and are ready to and capable of doing something about those side effects of the medicines that they're prescribing, including stopping the medicines when necessary. I personally think a way much, much better model is the integrated model that's being discussed as part of the patient-centered medical home, as being investigated and promoted by Oregon's Department of Human Services. Their policy statement on integration of August 14, 2009 says that the DHS will systematically organize services in such a way that full integration of mental health, addictions, oral and physical health care is achieved during the next two biennia. And I think that having psychologists out prescribing psychotropic medications in silos really works in complete contradiction to that model, and I'd advise against doing that. So I think I'd end with the fact that primary care doctors are well prepared to take care of mental health issues in rural Oregon and are currently doing a good job, although we need more of them. And they'd be best served working side to side, preferably in the same clinics with psychologists, in ways where they can actually have access to psychosocial services and therapies so they don't feel the need to prescribe so much medication. Thank you very much.
One of you has 1 minute.
Respected Chair Greenlick and Thompson and committee members, I want to be very brief. My name is Satyanarayana Chandragiri. I'm a practicing psychiatrist. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist. I've been doing this business for 23 years in three countries. I've submitted a written testimony. So it kind of gives you the background. I'm the president-elect of Oregon Psychiatric Association. I work in a variety of settings. I've worked in underdeveloped countries where I was the psychiatrist for the whole island. I have been working in the rural eastern Oregon for the last 10 years. I am the psychiatrist in Harney County, 250 miles from here. Most important thing is my mother has schizophrenia, and I have lost several family members to suicide, ravages of mental illness. And I'm just going to briefly describe how my brother one day found my mother totally confused, and it turned out she had low sodium, which is unfortunately sometimes seen in schizophrenia patients. If he had not walked into her today, she wouldn't be alive. Last year, my dad died and our family came back together, but for somebody who identified that and got her the right treatment. I work in state hospital. I was the medical director in Salem Hospital. I do a telepsychiatric treatment in Eastern Oregon Burns, where I spend 12 hours each month, and I'm able to take care of an entire county. I used to do business with 21 Eastern Oregon counties when I was the superintendent of Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, now called Blue Mountain. Some of these patients who have mental illness also have complex medical conditions. Each week, I take hundreds of decisions, which has nothing to do with medical or mental health. I cannot separate them. I have never seen a single patient who did not have associated medical problems. So it's constantly we are having checklists run in our head and try to figure out what's going on. Everybody sounded so simple that you can call a primary care.
1 minute.
But most of the time, you are functioning like a primary care and triaging and then asking for help. This debate reminds me of 100 years ago, there was a Flexner report, I've just briefly cross-referenced, 1910, which went around looking at the quality of medical education in this country and found that we need to set some standards, which is the standard of medical education today. ACGME is another resource which talks about training needs. People with mental illness also have medical illness. They need the quality care. Let us not compromise on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Dr. Lay. I think it's the second time this term I've done this to you. And I also need to apologize to Chris Lockie and Megan Cahey. We are going to close this this session. If we get back to a work session, I'll invite you back to talk. And I do need to say this is the first time in five sessions of the legislature anybody's mentioned Alexander Flexner, so I...
Thank you.
you get an award on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to open an informational meeting on health system transformation and ask Dr. Goldberg and whoever else you have with you. Dr. Bonetto, excellent. And I would announce that I had hoped this would be... I hope this would be the first public hearing on House Bill 2390. Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair. I was saying I had hoped this would be the first public hearing on the -1 amendments to House Bill 2390. Except we couldn't post it. But that will be our vehicle for the legislative concept that's going to come out of this work. So. This is a serious opportunity to discuss what's going on. I'd really like you to spend as much time as you need to describe where we are.
It was my understanding we walk in tonight, Dr. Goldberg is going to hand us each a copy of the bill.
That's what I heard. So.
You got till 6?
Did you bring it with you? You didn't bring it with you.
Miraculously, it's the miracle of Wednesday night.
It's going to be an 8-day process, I can tell. Go ahead, Bruce.
We can laugh.
Or whoever, Mike, whichever.
Thanks this time.
Well, co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, Mike Bonetto with the governor's office, and thank you for having us today. I think the idea really was just to provide some background to our work over the last, I believe, 7 weeks on this health system transformation team. I think I'm just going to provide a kind of an introduction. I believe you have some documents in front of you that we'll be walking you through. I'll kind of take the lead in kind of setting the stage. I think Bruce is then going to kind of dive into some more details of kind of next steps of where we're going. To set the stage, this work really evolved out of the Health Policy Board. For the last year, the Health Policy Board has really been looking at developing a plan that was set forth based on House Bill 2009. And out of that plan, there was this action plan for health. And this really took in a lot of information from a payment reform committee to a quality committee to a workforce committee to health improvement. I mean, kind of all across the continuum, and putting that document together and understanding, you know, what was going to then be handed off to the legislature. And I think within that framework, we realized there was still a lot of details to be answered, and that really was kind of the impetus behind this transformation team to start getting into those details. I'd say even from the policy board and certainly from this transformation team, all of this has been public. We've had, I think, a tremendous amount of public feedback and input in this process, and we have 2 meetings left on this transformation team, but that has been public as well. As you turn to page 3, the charter that has been given to the health systems transformation team, you see in front of you, and this really, again, evolved from the Health Policy Board, but then also was really a directive from the governor to say, if we're going to move towards this transformation, we need some more experts behind this. We need to start putting the details of a plan together. So the work products that we were kind of tasked to deliver were some key elements around delivery transformation that you can see around standards, benefits, services, and integration. How do we better coordinate that care? Local accountability, global budget, and Bruce will talk more about that. And then really looking at this draft legislation that has been referred to already that is not yet finalized, but this is kind of we're in the final stage of that. Our job is really handing this over to the legislature for deliberation. So on page four, I think I just take a step back and provide some context of kind of why we're in this position of even looking at this health systems transformation team. And, you know, you guys have been already dealing with this on many different levels in terms of the increasing in healthcare costs. I think the governor's position has really been looking at this as an opportunity more than anything else and figuring out how can we use this this budget situation to really look at delivery transformation. The premise behind all of this work has been using the Oregon Health Plan population and then building on top of that. And again, from the state's perspective, you're purchasing services and healthcare for 850,000 lives. That's OHP, and that's PEB and OEB. So the idea was to start first with OHP and then really look from a longer-term perspective of how do we begin to roll more lives in if we're going to begin to deliver better value. On page five, I'm sure many of you from the budget perspective have seen numbers like this, but I think this provides some perspective of just the need to move and to move quickly. And this just shows the difference and the discrepancy between expenditures and revenues projected over the upcoming biennia. The dotted lines, I think, are of significance. Basically, if you take the top dotted line, which would be projections of the best four biennia in revenue, and that bottom dotted line being the worst four. And I think, you know, the main takeaway is that even if you took the best four biennia in revenue over and compared it to the projections in expenditures, we're still below where we need to be. And I think that's really kind of the call to arms to say, you know, what can we do and what could we do now on the transformation front. On slide six, you'll see just these comparisons in the rate of increase for PEB, for Medicaid, and then just for the state general fund. And again, you'll see that discrepancy. I think we've seen for the last two biennia roughly 16% increases each biennia in PEB, I think roughly 15% on Medicaid, and 11% in the state general fund. And obviously those numbers don't add up when you're trying to balance a budget. I think that's where we're trying to obviously get our arms around right now. On page seven, it provides just some perspective of what we're dealing with immediately with this current biennium. And if you back up to what happened in the 09-11 session, really about roughly $2 billion was allocated for Oregon Health Plan dollars and long-term care. But the issue was we really balanced that with a significant amount of one-time money, and the majority of that being federal stimulus dollars. And then when you overlay that with the projections of caseload growth for the upcoming biennium of 11-13, you have over a $3 billion piece that would be funded if you were to continue as is. What was put in the governor's budget was $2.3 billion. So obviously there is a significant delta there. And if you look in detail at the governor's budget, this really has been broken down into two pieces. And one would be, I would say, more of the traditional budget cuts, which would be both in provider payments and in benefit. And that totals roughly $550 million. And then the balance of that really is looking at a new way of delivering care, some new integration and efficiencies that can be achieved that we haven't really pushed on. And that's the remaining $300. And I think that's really where this health system transformation team is I think, really driving and trying to understand, you know, how can we create a new model that's going to be able to help deliver those dollars. The issue is, if those dollars aren't achieved through system efficiencies, then, you know, we do have to kind of go back to the table and figure out, are we going to go back to traditional cuts in terms of payment and benefits? And that's really what we're trying to avoid right now. And I think from the governor's perspective, he's really made it very clear that when you look at how you can balance this budget, you really have those, your three traditional levers in terms of populations covered, the benefits that are covered, and the payments that are made for providers. And I think from the governor's perspective, he's made it very clear that he is not interested in cutting people. So that really leaves you with the two in terms of, you know, how do we change the payment side of things, and how can we be more creative on the benefit structure as well.
Mike, would you help me on this?
Sure.
Just to follow on that page 7, so I understand what you just said. The difference between 3.16, say 3.2 billion, and the 2.3 billion that's available is about 900 million. And you're suggesting that 900 million could be made up of 550 million in just straight old cuts, and perhaps 350 million or so in increased efficiency of the system. Is that how that those numbers?
That's right. That's right.
Thank you.
So, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. With that as a background, let me provide a little bit more detail about some of the vision. I think, as Mike laid out, you know, we've been talking for a lot of years about how we finance healthcare, how we can get more people the healthcare that they need. But, you know, the issue is really how can we change how care is delivered, so it's more efficient, so it's more effective, so it gets the value that we would all like. We've created an increasingly complex system. It's become increasingly unaffordable, as Mike indicated, for everybody. Those of us who get care in the system are becoming increasingly frustrated. Those who provide services within the system are becoming increasingly frustrated with it. We spend more than any other country. We don't have the best health status. And so the issue isn't how we can pay for more of that system. The issue that we're trying to tackle is how can we use this as a way to fundamentally change how care is delivered, to become more patient-centered, to get the outcomes that we need, to move the resources, to being able to prevent problems before they happen. So this is really about restructuring our healthcare system to create a better model of care so we can get what we want out of our health system, which is better health, better health care, a better quality, and lower costs so we can all afford it. And our vision is that to begin, in essence, as a pilot with individuals in the Oregon Health Plan, and then to, if we can get the outcomes that we would like out of that, to increasingly, we think, move more and more individuals, not just move individuals into that, but people will want to be part of a healthcare system that gets better outcomes at a better cost. And to begin with the Medicaid population for two simple reasons. As Mike just indicated, first and foremost, there's a budgetary imperative to do that. You know, the second reason is that it's a population that you as legislators, we have a state, have right now the most immediate ability to influence. So to begin to take the Medicaid population, to get approval from the federal government to also get the Medicare dollars that are associated with those in the Medicaid system, the dually eligibles, and create a new system of care for those folks. Create what we're now calling coordinated care organizations. That's the title of today. Dr. Greenlick had suggested the other night we call them EPCOT organizations.
Experimental prototype healthcare systems of tomorrow.
Dr. Greenlick, that was second. You just lost out by a hair to coordinated care organizations. But we're still trying to, I think, capture the right name for this. The federal government has begun to call these accountable care organizations. They're going to come out with standards sometime between today and probably a year or two from now. We really don't know when. And our goal is to create our own organizations here in Oregon, which will be consistent with what the federal government puts in place for Medicare, but which hopefully they can build on and we can actually grandfather in. So to create new coordinated care organizations that are locally accountable for the health of the population they serve and for the use of the health services. The vision is really to create organizations and communities that bring together the various pieces of the healthcare system, doctors, hospitals, pharmacists, who can come together in a shared model to figure out how to best deliver services to that population, rather than each functioning as its own entity, to establish some metrics and outcomes for what we want those organizations to do, to align people together to be able to get the care that we want. Right now we have great doctors, all of which do a wonderful job with the patients that come into their office, but we don't talk as communities for how we're going to use our resources across the community. What brings together the physician practices, the hospitals, et cetera. We need to align the incentives amongst both the providers of care as well as amongst those who get care in our systems to be able to support the goals that we want and to reduce and simplify the very complex system we have and be able to provide people an opportunity to navigate through it in a more effective way. And the concept is really one put together by the Health Policy Board. It's the diagram on page 10, which really says we need to better integrate and coordinate benefits and services, create a single point of local accountability for health and resource allocation for a community's population, to create standards for safe and effective care, and to do that within a fixed budget that isn't indexed to medical inflation, which goes up at 10 to 15% a year, but is indexed to something that's more sustainable, to a rate of growth that we can all afford. Consumer price index, state budget revenues, you name it. To redesign our delivery system around those four concepts, and hopefully to come out at the other end with better outcomes, better costs, and a healthier population. This is not an easy task. People have been trying to do this since the time of Abraham Flexner in 1910. It's going to take a while to do this. And the object here was to, and I'm not trying to underestimate, you know, I'm not trying to oversimplify that you can just take a hugely complex healthcare system and change it overnight, but we certainly know we need to try and move towards a better direction. This really creates a multi-year concept where, as Mike indicated, in year one, quite frankly, to meet some of the budget targets, the only tools that we have are some of the rate reductions and benefit reductions that are available to us. But to use that time to further refine what we've been working on Wednesday nights and to really begin to implement a new way to deliver care, which would be fully implemented in year two. And in year two, be able to start to get some of the efficiencies and some of the savings out of the system. And the year two changes are to, one, better coordinate and integrate care between physical health, mental health, oral health, eliminate a lot of the fragmentation that exists in our system, to get federal approval to pool Medicare and Medicaid funds. We have a number of individuals on the Oregon Health Plan who part of their care is paid for through Medicaid, which is the state and the federal government. Another piece is paid for by the federal government in Medicare by a totally different set of rules. And the whole idea is to put that together into the same community organization so that we can have better control, better management over those funds. Create these organizations to manage to a fixed rate of growth. Hold organizations accountable, not just for cost, but for quality, for outcomes, for health, and to build upon what are the best practices in our local communities. You know, Mike's indicated what the year one reductions are, so I won't go through that again. But let me get at what some of the benefits we can get from reorganizing care in this way. You know, we can certainly begin to start to reduce preventable conditions. to be able to incentivize organizations and people so that rather than having individuals show up in hospital emergency rooms with asthma attacks, we know we can prevent that by creating better upfront care for people with asthma, to work with pharmacists in communities to be able to get individuals asthma inhalers. We can prevent a lot of the problems for which people currently get care. We can do that certainly through the widespread use of primary care medical homes, providing people with the opportunity to have access to good coordinated primary care services, which we know based on pilots around the country can reduce the need for hospital care by 5 to 10%. We can get improved outcomes due to enhanced care coordination between dentists and doctors and hospitals and mental health providers. We know there's great opportunities for reducing errors and waste. And one of the ways we can do this is having these organizations institute innovative payment strategies to be able to start to pay for care in different ways rather than paying simply for quality, to be able to pay for outcomes, to be able to pay for quantity. Thank you. You've heard me talk about this before, Dr. Greenlick, so you know exactly what I meant.
None of them are paying for quality now, yeah. So it has to be somehow.
We're paying for quantity, and we're not paying for quality. We're not paying for outcomes. If you've been to a hospital or to a doctor, you often get a bill that itemizes. I went through a bill for my father that had pages and pages and pages of itemized expenditures, and the issue is what was the outcome of his hospital stay? How do we build on best practices? One of the things about healthcare that we know is that by establishing centers of best practice and best outcomes, those are often not the most expensive. That, you know, in many times, using best practices and the highest quality care is a way to get the not just the best quality, but the best value. And the notion is to really create a single point of accountability for that in communities. In year three, we would use this redesigned delivery system, hopefully, to begin to move others into this. Teachers, public employees. And I would say that if we are successful, as I indicated before, this isn't about moving individuals into it. It would be that local businesses would want this as the delivery system for their employees. I'd certainly want it for my family. And hopefully that's what we can create. You know, the transition is difficult, and we don't want to in any way underestimate that. I think to make this kind of transition is going to mean a couple of things. Number one, it's going to mean us understanding that our healthcare system hasn't gotten us what we want. We do need to establish a common vision of a better future and a different healthcare system. I think we're going to have to understand that the transition is going to take some shared sacrifice as we transition from where we are to where we need to be. We're going to have to provide some flexibility as a state to allow organizations the ability to better manage both the reductions in year one as well as the transition. That's going to mean state flexibility around some regulatory relief. We've begun to have conversations in our group on Wednesday night about tort reform and a variety of the other places where we've got to put a whole number of pieces together. There are some risks. The risks are that, you know, certainly reductions in the budget were based on what we're spending in 2009-11. They haven't even been indexed to the 2011-13 increases in medical inflation. That makes them steeper. Making significant transformational change is difficult in even the best of environments, and we have a difficult environment. We are taking resources out. We have a very, very difficult fiscal environment, and that's going to make it harder. We know that there can be some problems along the way. Access to care could suffer. We're going to need federal approvals that are not a guarantee, but we believe we can get. That if we make reductions too steeply, or if some of the transition goes in a difficult way, that we can lose valuable infrastructure. And we're going to need to guard against simply shifting costs from one sector to another. I mean, those are certainly some of the risks, and I don't think any of this is risk-free, but we have to acknowledge them and, I believe, start to put plans in place to mitigate each and every one of those risks. What's been our progress to date? Well, we've begun to work on creating this concept. We've been working with a group of our 45 closest friends on every Wednesday night, and we've made a tremendous amount of progress. We've begun to develop a definition for what these organizations would look like, what their scope would be, what their governance, what their budgets would look like. These are really rough cuts. We need to continue to refine it. We're not going to have this all set and packaged next week. This is going to be something that's going to take work through the rest of the legislative session and through the interim. We've begun to put together a detailed list of the kind of administrative simplification and regulatory relief that folks would need. Representative Hoyle and Freeman put out a note to doctors, hospitals, managed care plans, a whole host of folks that asking for what are some of the administrative barriers that you have now. We've got about a 50, 60-page list. We are putting that together now, and the agency, we've got an first week in April deadline to come back with a detailed plan for which of those things we can do. Some of the things are out of our control, but those that are, we will enact, and there's some cost savings in that. We've been compiling some ideas for additional cost savings that have emerged through this Wednesday night process. We're beginning to develop some of the metrics and outcomes that we'd want from such a system. We're working on a draft legislative concept. We presented one to the group last week. That's certainly going to need extensive refinement, but we hope that that's going to be what happens. The next steps are really to finalize the work of this group Wednesday night next week, which is really the roughest of cuts, and then to hand it off to the legislature to begin to better refine what would be a legislative concept, better refine a lot of the work that we've been doing. And then there's still going to be a lot of work that will happen during the next year. How would budgets for these organizations be set? How do we mitigate for issues around disparities in risk from one part of the state to another? Setting global budgets, coming up with the metrics and outcomes.
Yeah, don't forget the double aim.
correct. Well, Representative Greenlick is referring to, we've been talking about the triple aim, which is better health, better outcomes, better quality, and better cost. He's renamed it the double aim. So it means our work is now a third easier. And we very much appreciate that. But we're gonna hand this off to the legislature, and you'll take it. And then eventually do what happens is hopefully hand it back to those of us in the agency to begin to implement over the next year.
Bruce, let's open it up to questions. But in the background for those questions, the overriding question is, why do you need legislative action at all? And think about what we're talking. Why can't you just go ahead and do whatever you need to do? Because that will frame where we are as we go along. All right, who's first? Mm-hmm. James.
A couple of things. First of all, if you really want quality and speed, have you thought about writing the legislature into this for initial coverage?
might help us all. Secondly, what's the thought process for how this might roll out? Are we thinking about so many dollars per capita? I'm trying to reconcile, we've been down this road before, I'm trying to reconcile rural counties with metropolitan areas and how we get any kind of equity, not that we have it now, but when you start taking the dollars and saying we only have so many dollars, where are we going to put them? You have any thoughts on how this formula might look?
Co-chairs, yes. There are a lot of tools that currently exist within the healthcare marketplace that commercial insurers use, that others use, to do what's called risk adjusting populations. That means that we know that there are places in the state, not every place has the same healthcare risks and needs, and or the same healthcare delivery at their disposal. And so there are some tools that can be used, that have been tested, that get used by insurers, by medical groups, by others, to adjust for the differences in risk. And then create, and we use those right now in the Oregon Health Plan. We risk adjust the different health plans around the state based on a number of medical factors of the folks that are the recipients in those health plans. So we can use those tools to risk adjust and, in essence, create scores, and then, based on that, apportion the dollars in a way that reflects if a place has 25% greater risk, it would get 25% more dollars based on that population. But, you know, I don't want to simplify it yet. I want to provide you with the confidence that I believe, and what you'll see tonight is over the next 6 months, we could bring together a group of state national experts, some representatives from the legislature, and, you know, work out that model. It's been done before.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And to extend that one more layer, are we going to be in a position to entertain some early adopter demonstration projects, or do you see this as something that's going to go out statewide all at one time on AFPs? Or
what we've been co-chairs, what we've been talking about. Can we didn't want to steal the thunder from tonight, but absolutely. You know, the sooner we can implement some of this, the better. And so the goal is to create some opportunities for early adopters. Hopefully, what would be in to begin to put that together in the fall and have those up and going in January. And that would be on a more voluntary, early adopter way that we can amend contracts that the state currently has. And then to really look at full-blown RFPs and full-blown statewide coverage in year two.
One more? Go ahead. Representative Cannon next.
One of my interests is I really want to see the opportunity for communities to pull themselves together and pick this thing up. Now, I realize there are already corporate vultures. The smell of carrion is in the air, you know, and whatnot. And that's fine. If some areas that may work. But I would really like to see a model where if some communities or counties or whatever want to try this on their own with what they already have on the ground and enhance that we'd be able to do that without having to go through, you know, New York's mega insurance company model that will be brought in type thing. I think we'll get better buy-in. That's one of the reasons I will continue to remind you that whether we call it an ACO or whatever we call it, the word community will be in there.
think that's a good idea.
No, co-chairs, I think that's exactly right. I mean, this has been the delicate dance of in terms of finding, you know, how much flexibility and how much specificity is put in there. And I think, you know, there has to be some acknowledgement that when you have an entity taking on that much risk, you know, there has to be some competency, you know, that we're dealing with. But I think once we can establish that, we would love to have as much participation as possible.
And it's based on the theory that all health care is delivered locally. Mm-hmm. And how can we push the accountability and the responsibility and the organization at that local level? Because that's where it's going to work. It's not going to work when... I was going to say someone from New York, but I'm from New York. So that won't work. It certainly won't work with someone from New Jersey.
That we can agree on.
Okay. Yeah. Someone from New Jersey tells you how to... No, all healthcare is organized and delivered locally. And this really is based on the belief that if we can... put the responsibility and accountability to communities that they can rise to the occasion. Oh, yeah. And we want local communities to innovate.
Except
I mean, that's the whole idea.
Your concept of the healthcare region is bigger than state or something. I mean, it really is.
Well, we'd have to be viable. Yeah, right.
That's the word. It has to be
big enough to
large enough to be viable, and that really looks at what we've been talking about as natural communities of care, where it's got those resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question was going to perhaps tug you in the other direction a bit, because I was going to ask for a little bit more detail about what a coordinated care organization might look like. So maybe you can talk about it just in terms of hypotheticals. For example, in some part of the state, it might look like X. And one of the questions that's on my mind is how it would be different than managed care organizations and what its relationship might be with an MCO.
Sure. Co-chairs representing Cannon, I think that's been a big question on a lot of folks' minds. And I think, you know, again, we're trying to be as flexible as possible. But to answer your question, some scenarios. Certainly, we've got some amazing managed care organizations today that I think many are looking at this as potentially an opportunity to evolve into a different role. I think when you start looking at the scope, what Bruce was outlining earlier in terms of the scope and governance, I mean, these are completely different than what exists today. I mean, if you look at what exists today on the managed care front, you really have a very structured physical health component. So the outreach, the interaction, the coordination between, you know, mental health and dental health really doesn't exist. But yet we know we've got some very, very high cost, you know, chronic disease states within those frameworks. So I think there is that piece that we're really trying to get our arms around. The other big piece, though, is really looking at the governance side and understanding, you know, how do you make this more collaborative, even from a community perspective? You know, where do the counties fit in? How do kind of other local entities fit together? And I think that's going to really kind of push people to think, you know, how can they evolve? I think what we've really trying to say, I mean, we know certainly pockets of innovation that's occurring across the state, and I think the last thing we want to do is stifle that and to say, you know, become very prescriptive, say, you know, you've got to really fit in this box. You know, we're really more interested in those outcomes to say, you know, if you can deliver your per capita cost, you can deliver quality metrics and everything else, then we want you to, you know, continue down that road. So what's going to happen here in Salem, I can pretty much guarantee it's not going to be the same down in Roseburg or on the coast. And I think that's a good thing. I think we want to see actually that level of innovation and really start to compare of what can be a kind of a new level of best practice.
And let me just add to that in terms of I think that the traditional managed care model that was developed in the 80s and 90s was really around how to reduce costs by either limiting care, also how to reduce costs by negotiating better contracts and pitting one group against another. The model here isn't having, you know, an entity that really has no stake in that, looking to squeeze one component of the healthcare system against another. This is really about how do you create an organization that can bring together doctors and hospitals and pharmacists to share in delivering care in a community, sharing, understanding how to best utilize the resources, not having one try and compete for one others, but to create a kind of a shared governance and a shared way to begin to have communities look at how and where to expend those dollars. And that creates a really different kind of a paradigm. I think the other issue is to how to do that now within what's a fixed budget. And that's another piece of this, is when you, I believe, put those two components together, which is you create the imperative for community innovation by creating a fixed budget that doesn't simply say, we're going to just grow things by medical inflation and keep paying for it, whether it's of value or not, and create a shared governance model in communities where no longer do you have different segments of the healthcare system competing against each other for payment, but really working together for the health of the community. I do think you create something it looks very different, acts very different from what was a traditional managed care organization.
But Bruce, you need a deep pocket as a part of that, right? I mean, when you're saying to whatever this group is, whoever they're made out, here's how much money you have this year. It's in a pot. Here's how much responsibility you have to provide care. And the question is, what happens if the money's not enough to provide the care that's being delivered? I mean, that's where that's going to be the bottom line question. It's going to be, we're $49 million short. We have all these bills. We deliver the care. Who eats the $49 million? I mean, that's the ultimate question at the bottom of this, I think.
Chair Greenlick, I agree. And so part of that is going to be how these new organizations assume risk and exactly putting into place what happens in those mechanisms, because you could pay everybody a lot of money up front and run out at the end. I think we're going to have built in the kind of accountability for being certain that communities are going to need to demonstrate that they'll be able to live within those resources. So that may mean understanding that a group of services in a community may need to be capitated. Some services it may make sense to capitate in that way.
I don't know if I want to follow up after Bruce's comments there. So. You're kind of getting to where I was going, because we do have a fixed budget that we deal with. And, you know, we talked about this in my office or on the elevator. I don't know. We've been meeting in frequent spots, Bruce, but of offering somebody, kind of like we do with the Oregon Trail card, a health card like that, where you walk in, just slide it, the provider would receive payment at that point of $125 or whatever we negotiate with them, and they know they get five visits a year or something like that for a public type system, is kind of what I envision as something simple. The providers would like it because they've moved out of that realm of having to deal with billing insurance, so they could drop the cost down and they could go to somebody like Zoom Care, who I've mentioned, or an urgent care clinic, and be paid quickly. And that way we can handle the cap, too, at that point, because everybody knows what they have and they know, oop, I better not just go for a runny nose. I better make sure I have a problem before I go.
Unless that doctor sends somebody off for a 10-day hospital stay.
Yeah, and that's where the
other
issue.
You don't have that in your card, and that's going to be the problem.
That's when they go and borrow your card.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real issue.
I think what you're identifying is both, the issues of risk and responsibility, both on the individual level as well as at the community level. I think these haven't been issues that any of us have been able to successfully work through anywhere in the country. I think that beginning to put the accountability and financing into the hands of local communities begins to be a step, I believe, towards some of the things that you're talking about, Representative. And I think what I think we agree on is doing things as we have hasn't gotten us where we need to go yet. And so we certainly need some pretty significant change.
Is that the only thing we agree on, Bruce?
I think we agree on other things. I hope.
Well, again, the last question. Why do you need us? You've got all the authority of the governor. Why don't you just go do it? I mean, it's a serious question. That's not... I mean, are there things you need statutory authority to do? So our question
yes.
can be, do we give you the statutory authority or not screw around with what it is you want to do?
Chair Greenleck, members of the committee, I think we need statutory approval to do a couple of things. One is to put together, to blend Medicare and Medicaid funding. And request a waiver from the federal government to do that will require legislation. So that's certainly one-page
bill, right?
One piece. I do believe that...
What I'm saying is don't give us any more to do than you really need to give us to do. Because that's, we'll have a month to do it in. It's going to confuse the issue. Anything you can take the responsibility for doing, don't do it. We're not. I mean, then we can bitch about it. But that's a... Our role should be as minimal as can be, I believe. Don't get in your way.
And I guess, if I may, Mr. Chair, I say maybe the counterbalance to that is I suspect the governor and some other people need some buy-in.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I think... Part
it
of this
need to be legislation.
I don't know. I think you ask a really good question. I think there's got to be a way that this has, because otherwise it creates chaos.
I think my point is, we should have to do what we should have to do, because there are statutory impediments to what you want to do. But you shouldn't hand us an outline and then have us spend the next month changing what it is you think we should do. I don't think that's going to be feasible to do. And I mean, I think the governor's got to take some responsibility and then ask us for what you need. And as long as it's not money, it'd be easy. Representative Thompson will give it to you.
I think these people are amenable to the idea of giving us something and we give a 24-hour turnaround. So I don't think...
we have the Senate, so it will take 48 hours.
Okay.
But I do believe that... There's certainly a strict interpretation of what one certainly needs statutory authority to do. I do believe that certainly from where I sit as an agency director that often has to implement policy, having the support and a sense of the directions that we're moving in are the directions that the legislature and the people of the state want through them is very beneficial, because what then allows us to do is to have the confidence to go out and implement and not fear that 6 months later someone will come back and say, well, that's not what we really wanted you to do. So now we're going to pass a law that tells you to stop doing something instead of enacting legislation which sets out a vision and a road to go by and then charges the agency to fill in the details and manage it, which is really what we should do. We should agree on a common destination. And then I would hope that the legislature has the confidence in the governor and the executive branch to implement and to move that through and ultimately to finance it. So that's, I believe, hopefully what we need and how we need to work together. And, you know, there's a lot in between the two that I think we have to work through.
Let's just something else. I really appreciate you guys coming. You guys have worked extraordinarily hard on this, and tonight or maybe next week, your secret's going to be revealed. Everybody's waiting for it. You get the secret plan. I hope it's not the Wizard of Oz back there. Thank you. Thank you so much for
coming. Thank you.
Thanks.
Close the informational hearing, and we will adjourn. Good job.